From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With the number of COVID-19 infections and deaths rising precipitously over the past few weeks, it is no surprise that Thursday's Labor Department data showed that the number of unemployment benefit seekers was also increasing. About 1.4 million Americans filed for jobless benefits last week, even as the $600 a week of COVID-related relief is set to expire in days. Senate Republicans in the White House appear to be unprepared and disorganized, as ideas are being tossed around, rejected, raised in piecemeal fashion, and rejected again. My guest is Josh Bivens, Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He's regularly testified before the U.S. Congress on fiscal and monetary policy, the economic impact of regulations, and other issues. He's the author of numerous books, including Failure by Design, The Story Behind America's Broken Economy. Welcome to the program, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about these benefits, because this is a big aspect of the negotiations over the COVID-19 relief bill. When they were first enacted, Republicans argued, saying that they were too generous, but Democrats managed to push them through. What is the impact, as far as you can tell so far, on unemployed Americans having had this $600 a week?
For the past couple of months that this sort of extended or enhanced $600 weekly payment has been provided, I think it has been an absolutely crucial lifeline for the tens of millions of Americans who've lost their job or been forced not to show up at work for public health reasons. I think you'd have had a lot more economic distress, a lot more food insecurity, a lot more people missing their rent payments, and you would actually have had the economic impact of the virus spill over a lot away from the directly affected sectors of like shut down restaurants, and it would have spilled out over into the rest of the economy as restaurant workers and other laid off workers would have had to radically cut back what they were spending, even in still going sectors. So it's been a lifeline for families and households. It's also been a really crucial economic support for the economy at large.
Right, because those people who have that $600 a week have to spend it and because they've been relying on paychecks that got taken away that they were spending on other things. Now they were able to spend that $600 a week on necessities and anything else they needed. And we heard earlier this week that the GOP, well, first they just wanted to get rid of it entirely. You know, I suppose they assumed that the rates of unemployment would start coming down again. Then they decided that $100 a week would be sufficient. What do you make of that?
Cutting it back from $600 to $100 as an enhanced benefit, it would provide huge hardship on people who are relying on this and relying on it at a time when there just aren't jobs out there for people to go to. I mean, the Republicans like to tell a story about how this is a problematic policy because it keeps people from looking for jobs. But in the current environment, that's just really a nonsense argument. I mean, for one thing, it is still unsafe for lots of jobs that existed before the pandemic to exist again at the same scale. And then two, even if like we somehow got a handle on this virus, it's still going to be a long time before there's just enough demand for workers to soak up all of the people who've been thrown out of work because of the virus, the public health sort of ripple effects, the economic effects. So basically, you're just inflicting pain on people for no good reason at all. There's nothing they can do about the fact that the economy is not generating enough jobs for them to get to. And then on top of the pain for individual households, you're all of a sudden going to see a huge contraction in spending in the economy. And so even in people working in sectors like grocery stores or other places that still should have customers coming in the door, those customers will largely stop coming in the door if you've got lots of people having their $600 benefit reduced to $100. So it's going to be bad for the economy, not just bad for the economic security of individual families.
Republicans say that the benefits, the $600 a week in benefits, is a disincentive for jobless Americans because somebody making $600 a week staying at home would be less interested in taking a job that maybe paid $500 or $550 a week that was being offered to them. But of course, those jobs could simply raise wages, right, to $600 or more.
Exactly. I mean, they could definitely raise wages. And I would also say for tens of millions of Americans, it's gotten a lot riskier to go to work. For anyone who does sort of in-person service type jobs, the pandemic has made jobs a lot riskier to do. In a sort of textbook model of how the economy is supposed to respond to that extra risk, you're supposed to be paid more to take on that risk. And so to the degree that wages are not responding and not rising to induce people out of unemployment, I'd say that's a big market failure that the unemployment insurance benefit is actually helping to counteract. And then I would just add on top of this, if you're looking at the things that are holding back economic growth right now, the decisions of individual workers to decide not to work, it's just not high on the list. I mean, what's driving economic trends right now are the state of the virus and the state of overall demand in the economy. And I think the biggest argument, you know, obvious argument against this idea that disincentives are a big constraint on growth right now. In the last 2 months, we saw the fastest job growth in American history, 7.5 million new jobs created while we were paying the extra $600. So it did not stop people from going to the jobs when the jobs were created. And so that's the constraint on growth right now, is the economy creating enough jobs, not our individual workers making decisions about staying at home.
The other aspect of the bill is another round of $1,200 stimulus checks. The first round, from what I can tell, hasn't even finished dispensing yet. There are still people around the country, including me, who haven't gotten their stimulus checks. But for those who did get them, did that have a positive economic impact? And could a second round of checks also benefit people? These are checks that people get based on their overall income, regardless of having or not having a job.
Yeah, so those direct payments, very broad direct payments to people, I think they sort of helped. I think they provided some sort of aggregate demand in the economy, kept some spending going at higher levels than it would have otherwise had. I think if we had a Congress that was willing to do the smart thing here, which is just spend absolutely as much as is necessary to get the economy and families through this pandemic and through the resulting economic recession, I'd be fine with checks. Given that they instead seem really obsessed with keeping the overall price tag of these relief packages below some kind of arbitrary numbers, whether it's this one, maybe it's a trillion, maybe it's a trillion and a half, then those checks start to sort of trade off pretty sharply with things that I think are higher priorities, like the unemployment insurance enhancements. And then I would also add aid to state and local governments to keep them from cutting back later in the year. The checks to households, I think they're useful. They're not super well targeted. Like, you know, to put it really bluntly, even people who've been sort of privileged enough to keep working throughout this pandemic got a lot of those checks. If we've decided that we have to limit the size of overall packages, I think we need to target where the relief goes a little better than that. And so in that case, I don't like how much those checks trade off with more targeted policies like this aid to state and local governments and the enhanced unemployment insurance benefits.
So there was some talk from Republicans to limit those checks to those making $40,000 a year or less. Would that be an effective narrowing of that kind of round of stimulus checks?
I think so. And then I would hope we would spend sort of the difference between what the more broad checks and the more targeted checks, like that extra money that was freed up, I would want to plow it directly into things like the UI enhancement or aid to state and local governments.
There's also, you mentioned the state aid to states. And of course, this has been unfortunately very politicized. States are struggling. Revenues have dramatically dropped. And remind us what that means. I mean, what's at stake here when state revenues drop? Are we talking about school funding, public libraries, roads, you know, all of those basic services and infrastructure that state budgets fund?
Yeah, and all those things. I think it's a very predictable thing. When the overall economy slams into a recession, that reduces state and local revenues. Sales taxes crater because people buy less. Income taxes go down because people's incomes are hurt. And states and state and local governments are bound to balance their budgets. And so what that does is that puts tremendous pressure on them to cut spending to match the lower revenues. Now, to the extent that they can sort of try to raise taxes on their sort of more privileged residents and corporations to try to preserve that spending, they should totally try to do that. That's a very heavy political lift. The federal government is not bound to balance its budget in a given year. They are free to give state and local governments lots and lots of aid in the short run to keep those state and local governments from cutting spending and then seeing a big drag on economic growth going forward. And that's a really effective policy to make sure a recession doesn't sink in that much deeper. If you look at what happened after the Great Recession, state and local governments, after getting some aid in the Recovery Act in 2009 that kept them going through for about a year, really started to cut back spending after 2011. That became a huge drag on the recovery from the Great Recession. State and local spending austerity by itself probably set back a full recovery by about 4 years after the Great Recession. We should really avoid that kind of terrible mistake again and step forward with some federal aid this time.
And that isn't an aspect that gets discussed very much. I haven't really heard that aspect of the recovery from the recession before this. What about aid for schools and for education in particular? This also seems to be another issue that is unfortunately just being politicized. The White House actually ended up having to back off on its demand to reduce federal aid to schools. To those schools who wanted to continue online instruction, but even Republican lawmakers said that that was a bad idea. And now there has been, I understand, in the latest version of the bill, at least at the time that you and I are speaking, a little over $100 billion in coronavirus-related aid for schools. This is also something that obviously helps the economy. Most directly, it keeps teachers paid, right?
Exactly. I think on the one, there's a couple things going on. One is schools are financed out of those same taxes that are just going to be hammered over the coming year by the big decline in economic activity. And then on the other hand, I think the pandemic has forced schools into scrambling around to try to figure out how to safely educate kids and effectively educate them. That often means either pure distance learning or a hybrid of in-person or distance learning. All of this really requires more money, not less.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, maybe increasing the number of teachers hired because it takes, you need more teachers per classroom, I think, in order to effectively do online teaching. And that would also serve the dual purpose of giving some jobless folks, presumably, trained people who are trained in education, jobs.
Exactly. More personnel, even more equipment. The assumption that every kid has a good Wi-Fi and laptop set up at home to seamlessly go into a distance learning environment, that's not true. So in any sort of rational cost benefit of all this, we would be thinking, wow, schools need a lot more money right now to open safely and effectively. It's good that the worst suggestion of use state aid as a bludgeon to get people to reopen schools, safety, to heck with safety. I'm glad that was set aside. I will note that the $100 billion sort of floated in the Senate proposal this Thursday, it pales in comparison to an act passed in the House that would have provided $400 billion for school spending. And so I think that's sort of the level of difference in how serious the two parties right now are taking the schools' need for resources to reopen safely in this environment.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up the House. The reason why it's the Senate that's negotiating the White House right now is because the House already passed their version, something I believe it's about three times the size of the version that the Senate is discussing with the White House. I imagine the differences are quite significant. One of the issues that only gets raised by conservatives when it comes to social spending, but never when it comes to tax cuts for the rich, is the federal deficit. And I know this is an issue you've written about. Are Republicans bringing up the issue of deficit and federal government debt when it comes to this level of spending? And if so, is anyone pointing out their hypocrisy?
So they definitely have brought it up. People have definitely pointed out the hypocrisy. It's sort of amazing that just a bit over 2 years after they decided to give a $2 trillion tax cut to corporations financed entirely by deficit spending, they turn around and sort of wring their hands about debt levels being too high when we're talking about response to the worst economic crisis really of the 20th century, including the Great Depression so far, layered on top of an epidemic that requires all sorts of public response. So you know, I've heard that debt and deficit sort of argument a little less than you would normally expect, I would say, even from Republicans in this moment, because I think they realize right now how absurd it sounds. My guess is where that really becomes an even bigger constraint on policymaking, and even starts to tempt some sort of centrist Democrats, is more like 6 months to a year from now, when guaranteed we will still need substantial public support for the economy as well as virus response. And yet we won't be in the midst, you know, hopefully knock wood, in the midst of just the on fire crisis that we are right now. And so it's going to be a really dumb argument, even when it's raised 6 months or a year from now. Right now, only the truly brazen can really raise it as a reason why we shouldn't be ambitious in responding to the current moment.
And of course, a very easy solution for those who are really worried about going into debt is to raise taxes on the rich. I mean, Jeff Bezos just added, you know, another $13 billion to his massive fortune in a single day. The wealthy, especially the folks like Bezos, are getting so rich. I mean, he could easily give all of the gains that he's made in his income in a single day to the White House, to the Federal Treasury rather, and you know, that is a very, very direct way to replenish those funds that Republicans might be worried about us going into debt over.
Totally. I would say in the short run, debt financing works really well. There's nothing in the moment that says we've taken on too much and it's not doing any damage. And then in the long run, for an entire host of reasons, from leading to a more equal economy, making sure that, you know, really permanent public investments we need, not just responding to the crisis of the moment, but permanent investments that just pay off enormously in the long run, like early childhood education or elder care or climate change mitigation or expansions of health insurance. All of these things can be financed, like you said, by just asking people who've been just extraordinary beneficiaries of the enormous upward redistribution of income we've seen over the past couple of generations to pay higher taxes. That should be the solution.
I remember reading one story in the, you know, sort of midpoint of the pandemic between its starting and where we are now, that the fact that the wealthiest Americans had reduced their spending on luxury goods had hit our economy hard. And that, of course, the big story, the real story there is the fact that our economy was depending so heavily on spending on luxury goods by the wealthiest Americans. So spending on the majority, the 99% of us, has a big stimulative effect, as we've just been discussing. You know, we are at a time now where we're seeing the state of Texas and the state of Florida openly talk about how they're going to triage healthcare for COVID patients, because we don't have a Medicare for all system. We don't have single payer healthcare in this country. And so all of those warnings that Republicans were raising about government bureaucrats are going to be rationing care, it's happening in the current for-profit system. Don't programs like Medicare for All, and also the kinds of programs that even Joe Biden, a centrist Democrat, announced this week in terms of childcare, universal preschool, and elder care, don't those also have a really important stimulative effect on the economy?
For sure. And I would say that there's sort of, when economists talk about stimulus, they often mean like a short-term jolt to the economy, which can be super valuable when it's in crisis like now. And then even beyond the stimulus, I think programs like that just provide a huge long-run boost to sort of productivity and opportunity. Like you mentioned, the Biden campaign came out with a very good plan on investments in early childcare, universal pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, as well as a substantial investment in elder care. And there's a million reasons why those are good investments to make. Like, the research just shows that investing in kids when they're young provides huge benefits down the road, not just to the kids, but to the economy at large. They earn more money. They're more likely to work over the life cycle. They pay more taxes. All this actually finances itself. And then both things, elder care and child care, they free up people to join the paid labor force who otherwise have been forced into taking care of kids and their older relatives. And if we had that burden lifted off people with a professionalized, well-paid workforce that could really help people out, you would see a huge increase in labor supply and economic growth as people, you know, wouldn't have to do that on their own time and out of their own pocket. So yeah, I think investments like these not only solve real problems standing in the face of typical families, they're also good for the economy writ large.
President Trump, in what might be an apparent counterplan to Biden's, announced $5 billion in additional funding for nursing homes in the United States. But $5 billion, unfortunately, isn't very much. And it certainly isn't a substitute, I think, for the kind of universal coverage or of elder care that is needed. And anytime you raise these sorts of issues, of course, we have conservatives in this country reducing it to an ideological battle and accusing folks like you and I of socialism, of creeping socialism. And you know, that really this whole election in November is about the socialists wanting to take over the country and bring tyranny. You know, never mind that Trump has already, of course, unleashed federal agents on cities like Portland, Democratic-run cities. So, you know, how to, you know, are you hopeful that evidence of the kind that you as an economist present of the direct stimulative effects on our economy can help push the direction of the debate so that hopefully within 6 months or even within a year, we are going to have in place those things that our economy desperately needs that aren't just one-off, but actual infrastructure that helps Americans not fall through the cracks?
I hope so. I mean, you know, it's been a tough couple of years for people who rely on sort of evidence in winning political arguments.
I'll say.
That's what I've got to offer. So hopefully it makes a contribution of some kind. I do think, you know, a combination of people's lived experience along with evidence might make a real dent. I would say this unemployment insurance fight, I think, could be really illuminating to lots of Americans. Like that extra $600, I think, was a shock to many unemployed people, like how protective it was for them. Like, I think for years, they had gotten used to an American safety net. It was just unbelievably stingy, and unemployment felt like so stingy that it was almost not worth jumping through the hoops of trying to get it. And this time around, the hoops were terrible because so many people were applying because of the crisis. It was hard to get. But then when they got it, it was like, wait, we can afford this? Like, we can afford my spell of unemployment to not crush me? I can actually make rent and buy groceries just on an unemployment insurance check? And it turns out, yep, we can do that. It did not bankrupt the country. It's affordable. And so I am hoping, and I feel like in the debate about whether or not to let it just completely lapse or not, it has gotten people fired up in a way I haven't seen about debates like this. And so I'm hoping this brief 3-month experiment with actually providing a decent safety net rather than the patchy, stingy one might actually make people realize we can do a lot better than this and get them to think more broadly about even the things we've been talking about here.
Right. I mean, the idea of a universal basic income, you know, the $600 a week has come sort of closest to that, at least for jobless Americans that were able to apply for it, than this country might have seen in the past. Well, Josh, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. What's a good website where people can read about the work that you do?
It's at the Economic Policy Institute website, which is epi.org.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you.
My guest has been Josh Bivens, Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Again, that website is epi.org. And we've been discussing the next COVID-19 relief bill and whether Congress can get its act together in time to help Americans ride the economic storm. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.